This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, August 30th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We'll speak with Noah Glasgow of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent and Grace Ferguson of the New Bedford Light. Our State House correspondent Katie Lannon will let us know what's going on up in Beacon Hill, and we'll hear from CAI's Gilda Geist. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. An ocean-going protest took to the seas last Sunday as some fishing captains and others went to circle around Vineyard Wind's offshore turbines about 15 miles south of the islands. CAI's Jeanette Barnes has this story for us and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Give us a sense of the event. What do we know about how many boats were involved and how it was organized?
Well, about two dozen boats went out there, according to people who participated. They were mainly fishing boats, but various sizes and types. There were big commercial fishing boats, some charter boats, and also some recreational fishing boats. It was organized by the New England Fishermen's Stewardship Association. Although the Nantucket charter captains that I interviewed said they're not really members of that group. One of them heard about it through a local fishing group here. Like a lot of things these days, they organized online, I think, at least partly. They did promote it on their social media. This group, the New England Fishermen's Stewardship Association, is based in Maine. But of course, they would like to serve all of New England. And this is the third time, actually, that I've seen them come down to our area for something related to offshore wind. They seem to be kind of trying to take a leading role in the fishing community among those who oppose the installation of more offshore wind turbines.
Now, I know you spoke with at least one fishing captain who was there. What did you learn about their concerns?
Yeah, I talked with two charter captains who participated in this event. And I know that, you know, overall in the past, fishermen have had a variety of concerns about offshore wind. But this week, the ones I spoke with were really focused on a worry that wind farms could hurt fish stocks. Pete Kaiser, one of the Nantucket captains I spoke to, said, you know, when he hears people say, well, everything will recover from all this construction work, it makes him think of other fish species that are not in recovery, like cod. But of course, with cod, we know the scientific consensus there really is that overfishing was the problem. But I think the point that he's making is that, you know, disruptions to the ecosystem can have long-term consequences.
Now, we know that offshore wind doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's in big part, it's a response to climate change and trying to build out local renewable energy sources. I guess you could say that's the other side of this. And I know you reached out to an environmental group for some of that context with this protest going on. What concerns did you hear from the environmental group?
Yes, I talked with Oceana. It's a national group focused on ocean conservation. Gib Brogan, who's a campaign director for them, said they strongly support offshore wind. They believe, you know, it remains a necessity to help us move away from fossil fuels. And they believe it can be done responsibly with guidance from science. Also, you know, they talked about federal scientists who have looked at all the expected effects of turbines. These reports are kind of ongoing from the federal government, and they've determined generally that there should not be any threats to the overall populations. There are some expected mortality events of certain types of wildlife, but they do not believe that would be an overall population threat.
Now, in the meantime, another of these blades is reported to have failed. This is similar to the one south of the Vineyard that failed about a month and a half ago. But this one off the coast of England, we don't have a lot of details, but what can you tell us about this?
Yeah, this latest blade failure is the third problem with a blade of the same model, the Haliad X. And it happened at Dogger Bank, which is off the east coast of England. And this is the second failure actually at that same wind farm. So we've had three total, one at Dogger Bank in May, then Vineyard Wind, and now Dogger Bank again. The cause of this latest blade failure is not clear. And specifically the question of whether it has any relationship with what happened at Vineyard Wind, where there was a manufacturing defect that's been blamed for that. It's unclear if that's true at Dogger Bank. The manufacturer of these blades is GE Vernova. And when the first one happened back in May in England, they said it was an installation error. So we're still waiting to hear more about this latest one and what it might mean for this blade going forward. The company says it's investigating. It calls this an isolated event.
I want to take kind of a step back in this story. The National Marine Fisheries Service, also known as NOAA Fisheries, is issuing a new biological opinion on Vineyard Wind, this offshore wind company. Explain what this report is and why we're talking about it now when it hasn't even yet been fully released.
Yeah, sure. So this document that we're talking about, it's an evaluation by federal scientists of ways that the continued installation of turbines at Vineyard Wind could affect threatened and endangered species. They call this a biological opinion. And Vineyard Wind had to go through the process of getting this again because they still have more turbines to install. It comes from the National Marine Fisheries Service, and they announced several days ago that they had issued this opinion, but they weren't going to publish it for 10 days. So those 10 days are almost up, but we still don't have the full document. But they did send out some information about the main points.
So,
And then go
yeah,
ahead.
I was just going to say we do have a summary of these findings, and I have to say it doesn't seem like they are rewriting their opinion with this latest version.
Right. I mean, the spokeswoman, Andrea Gomez, told me directly that the government's conclusions about Vineyard Wind have not changed. We know it still says that Vineyard Wind will not kill or seriously injure any right whales. It says the installation work could temporarily disturb their behavior, but again, is not expected to cause any population level issues. And we know, with a North Atlantic right whales, that even injuring one animal is a population level issue. But they do expect some deaths to sea turtles, actually. The spokeswoman told me that the report is going to suggest that they expect one death per year on average to sea turtles.
The same environmental advocates you spoke with, Oceana, they have some concerns here as well. They're focused, it sounds like, on trying to ensure that these endangered North Atlantic right whales are protected.
Right. Oceana, although they favor offshore wind, it is not without this caveat that more should be done to separate offshore wind from critical whale habitat. Gib Brogan from Oceana said they have actually been a strong supporter of something that someone from the National Marine Fisheries Service proposed a couple of years ago in writing in a letter, and that is creating a buffer zone between habitat for, critical habitat for North Atlantic right whales and the wind turbines. And that buffer would essentially push the turbines farther away from land. Actually, some of Vineyard Wind's turbines are already built in that area that was proposed. And yet, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, a different federal agency, did allow that to continue in that area. So, it really doesn't look like the Biden administration is pursuing this buffer zone right now. But it is possible that could change, especially if we see any evidence of problems that they didn't anticipate.
Okay, I want to get on to a lighter story. It's good for heading into the holiday weekend. On Wednesday this week, the Sandwich Boardwalk was the site of a celebration with plenty of officials. Tell us what happened.
Yes, so finally, this was the ceremonial opening of the new Sandwich Boardwalk. It was first opened to the public back in May. But they had a few kind of punch list items, finishing touches that the contractors were working on. Summer rolled on, and then this week, finally, it was time to do that ribbon cutting on Wednesday. And the Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll came down. There were, of course, members of the Select Board speaking. Also, Christy Senatore from the Cape Cod Commission spoke as well.
And what was the scene like? Describe it for us. It was a nice day for it, plenty of sunshine.
Yes, it was a nice day. Everybody was gathered in the Boardwalk Road parking lot. So then, as you look at them, the boardwalk is like the backdrop behind them, and especially the bridge over Mill Creek. They went through the speaking program. There was even a cake there with a picture of the boardwalk on the cake. There was a lot of people to thank. The town manager, Bud Dunham, kind of made a crack that this is like the technical portion of the Oscars. He said it's going to be kind of dry, but there are so many people to thank. He did single out two people for special recognition. They were the assistant town manager, Heather Harper, and the town engineer, Sam Jensen.
I know you've reported on the boardwalk reconstruction over the years as it's been coming. It was actually quite a contested project at one point. We have just about a minute. Remind us what that was about, all that sort of contested energy around this project. And really what I want to know is what's your impression of how it turned out?
Well, yeah, the boardwalk needed to be rebuilt because of storm damage, rising seas, and things like that. So it did need some changes. It needed to be higher. It needed to be wider and safer for accessibility. And people had a lot of objections initially to the aesthetics of what they saw in the design. It's a classic wooden structure and all of that. It's a symbol of the town. Over the planning period, modifications were made to the design. As far as my impressions, I would say that the biggest difference is the railings. So now the railings go the whole length, not just on the bridge. And someone said to me there at the event, you used to feel like when the water was high, like you were just walking on water. There were no railings. Now there are. I would say, at least as an occasional user of the boardwalk myself, people who spend a lot of time there might feel differently. But for me, the overall shape and vibe of the boardwalk really is very similar to what it was before. They were able to keep the bridge footings too. So when you look at that, it's exactly as it was, but a little higher. They added to them. It's still beautiful. It's still the sandwich boardwalk that people know and love.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks for walking the boardwalk for us.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
Later this morning, climate activists will be demonstrating on the Bourne Bridge. CAI's Eve Zukoff has details on why they'll be hard to miss. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Tell us what drivers crossing the Bourne Bridge, and there should be plenty arriving for the holiday weekend, should expect today.
Yes. Okay. So from 10:30 to 1 p.m., there will be a group of people. You won't miss them, I don't think. They'll be head to toe in red with white painted faces. They're going to be walking silently back and forth across the bridge, doing a kind of synchronized performance. This is the so-called Red Rebel Brigade, which is, they call themselves an international performance activist troop for Extinction Rebellion, which is an international climate and environmental movement.
And this isn't the first time that this group has been on the bridge. What kinds of receptions have they gotten in the past? You've covered them a couple of times.
Yeah, we've been out there a few times. This is the fourth year that they've been here, and they're doing it now, we should say, because they're trying to raise Labor Day tourists' awareness about climate change as they come to the Cape. We've got this fragile ecosystem here, so I don't think they mind the reception, which is mixed, as you might imagine. I've been out there, and I have seen a lot of honks in support, but also a lot of fingers hanging out windows. And I think this election cycle, probably one of the most important elections we've had ever, we've got the primaries on Tuesday, make this kind of group maybe extra inflammatory to people who do not support their message right now.
Let's talk about another story that you covered this week. A group of residents from Hyannis and Yarmouth are working together to understand how PFAS is traveling through the environment. These are these forever chemicals. What are their concerns?
The concern for the Hyannis PFAS community working group, this really a group of residents, is basically that there is PFAS from Hyannis Gateway Airport and the former Barnstable County Fire Training Academy and elsewhere that could be interacting with one another in our aquifer, in our surface waters, and in our local ecosystems. So specifically, they're worried that Yarmouth continues to be the recipient of contamination from the airport despite cleanup efforts. And of course, all of this matters because PFAS are what are called forever chemicals. They don't break down and they accumulate in our bodies, and they've been linked to cancers, some fertility issues, and a range of other health issues.
So what is this citizens group trying? How are they trying to approach this problem right now?
Well, at the moment, what they're doing is they're using a state grant to analyze data from the airport's PFAS plumes with the help of a water quality specialist. But they say it could be a few years before they get through all the data.
Okay, one last story before you go. You talked to Steamship Authority officials about efforts to sell two ferries This doesn't happen every day. What does the process look like?
No, they're trying to sell the Katama and the Gayhead. And for buyers who are kind of interested...
If this, you're out there listening right
if
now...
If you're out there listening, you've always wanted to buy a ferry since you were a little kid. You know, this process starts with finding an ad the Steamship Authority posted. We saw one in Boats and Harbors online publication that advertises the Katama as a 235-foot ferry with approximately 143 passengers and 40 car spaces. The ad says that all bids will be accepted until 2 p.m. on September 10th. And then Bob Davis, general manager of the Steamship Authority, said that the boats will go as is to the highest bidder. And look, these boats are 40-some-odd years old, so the Steamship Authority is hoping for maybe $100,000 each more if they're lucky, but... Not getting too greedy there.
So what replaces them? The Katama and the Gayhead do a lot of service.
They
have
do.
Done a lot of service over the years.
They do. They will be replaced by two new boats that should be arriving this fall called the Barnstable and the Aquina. They are also coming used, but just by a couple of years, and they'll be about 10 feet longer than their predecessors, not hugely different to the naked eye. But yeah, those should be in use this fall.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you.
This is the news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Noah Glasgow of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the news roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Running a business on Martha's Vineyard increasingly comes with a sideline. That is becoming a landlord in order to provide housing for employees. Noah Glasgow of the Vineyard Gazette is here with the story. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
One of the staggering things about your story is just the breadth of island businesses that seem to have felt compelled to find ways to provide employee housing. Can you give us some examples right here at the beginning, just so people have an idea of what we're talking about?
Yeah, sure. Island businesses of every size and shape feel the need to provide employee housing. I spoke with restaurant managers, bar owners who rent one or two apartments to provide them at a subsidized rate to employees. But I also spoke with Denise Capici at Martha's Vineyard Hospital. The hospital rents 135 properties across the island from 81 different landlords in order to maintain its staffing needs.
I think people listening might imagine that this is a summer predicament, and at some level it is much worse in summer, but it's certainly not entirely seasonal.
No, in fact, one thing that's really driven the need to provide housing to employees is the general rise in rents and actually the collapse of year-round rentals on the island. As more properties have transitioned into the short-term rental market or the summer rental market, it's very hard for employers to keep somebody year-round. So at a place like Morning Glory Farm, where previously the employee housing needs were almost entirely seasonal, now something like half of the employees that they have in housing are in fact year-round, and they're currently expanding their portfolio of housing by building a bunch of cabins that are designed specifically to accommodate year-round essential staff that keep the farm running.
Talk a little bit about what kinds of challenges this presents for business owners. You say that most of them have no desire really to be landlords.
Yeah, so when the state secretary of housing came to the Vineyard earlier this year, he met with a whole panel of business owners, and to a person, every single one of them said, we're not in restaurants, we're not in farming, we're not in healthcare to be landlords. We're there to do what we want to do. And so the goal here is to use employee housing as a stopgap measure until something like a more permanent solution to the island's housing crisis emerges.
Even as landlords of your own employees, there are these challenges in terms of if you have an issue with an employee, you're also their landlord. If you have an issue with them as a tenant, but they're also your employee. And then also you're managing the physical space of these buildings. And anybody who takes care of a home knows, you know, what it takes. And then it's a rental property. There's always things that are breaking. It's a whole undertaking, a sideline that these business owners are being forced into.
That's right. I mean, I know that the hospital employs somebody whose sole responsibility is to travel between their rental properties to fix things like broken screens, broken air conditioners, malfunctioning refrigerators, you know, just basically a handyman who can keep up with those difficulties. At Morning Glory, they have somebody who lives in one of their housing properties to keep tabs on people who are living there to make sure that the facilities are working properly and that the tenants are getting along and that interpersonal difficulties aren't flaring up. At the Harborview Hotel, where there's, you know, a fluctuating range of employee housing properties that are rented, you know, they use their engineering staff and their housekeeping staff to keep those properties in shape.
I'm interested in the takeaway here. Many of these businesses and business owners are pointing to a role for local government and community efforts to create more housing for employees island-wide, and saying that what they're doing here with these little stopgaps is not a long-term solution.
That's right. Other seasonal communities have really pushed to build large-scale workforce housing. In Provincetown, for instance, that's taken the form of a development called the Barracks, which is designed to accommodate, in sort of dormitory-style living, a large number of employees. On the Vineyard, though, that there hasn't been really a push towards that. Each town has put in place smaller measures that are designed to sort of stimulate and help bolster developers who are looking to build workforce housing or business owners who are trying to get into the workforce housing business. But, you know, there's been calls from business owners and from local housing advocates to really pool resources across the island towns and try and make some headway on a larger workforce housing project that could take some of the pressure off these local businesses.
It's Noah Glasgow of the Vineyard Gazette, where you can read the article. There's some great photos that go along with it showing some of the housing that different businesses have created for their employees. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
If you want to know the health of ponds in the town of Brewster, don't bother checking the regional cyanobacteria monitoring map. All of Brewster's data there has been grayed out. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here to explain. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
The Brewster Health Department, I guess, is in a battle over the posting of advisories of the health of its ponds, which means its data is not available in this source.
Exactly. The Health Department in Brewster had a disagreement with the Association for the to Preserve Cape Cod regarding the posting of the data on cyanobacteria contamination results that they get from tests. Basically, the health department is asserting their right under the state law to be the sole source of any advisories that issue because of any problems in the pond. And this sort of coalesced recently with two of the ponds, of the 20 ponds that were monitored in Brewster, the upper and lower mill pond. There were some testing that indicated there could be some cyanobacteria blooms there. And the APCC sort of on their maps, if you go to their website and look at their maps, where there are cyanobacteria blooms, the ponds are colored in red. So they redded out both these ponds, and Brewster health officials objected to that because they said the only indications were around certain areas of those ponds. And the rest, they indicated there may not have been a problem. So they were concerned that this was sort of overreaching on the part of the APCC. So they asked the APCC to remove all of the data from their maps related to the town of Brewster.
It's interesting. I learned this reading your article here, that the state doesn't have a specific level that it sets for cyanobacteria within ponds as, you know, triggering a warning.
That's true. Apparently, the state has, you know, regulations regarding E. coli and other contaminations in surface water, but at this point, they only have recommendations regarding cyanobacteria. You know, and that's a concern, I think, for you know, that's one of the reasons why APCC is sort of more aggressive about this. They feel that there should be more specific regulations about it, because there have been problems. And as we know, cyanobacteria can cause people who bathe in those waters to get sick. It's especially troublesome for pets. Pets can actually they can actually die from ingesting cyanobacteria.
What do people do then in Brewster if they want to know how safe their ponds are?
The health department is issuing their own advisories on the town's website. So if people in Brewster want to know what the condition of the ponds are, they can go to the town's website under the news link, and they can see whether there are any postings or not. And right now, those postings have all been lifted. The waters, they say, are fine in Upper and Lower Mill Pond.
Hey, Tim, before I let you go, I do want to point to another story in the paper this week. A longtime Chatham fisherman was killed this past week in a tragic car accident. You have remembrances from many folks who knew him. Talk about him just for a moment.
Sure. Eddie Footer, a 57-year-old shell fisherman and commercial fisherman who lived in Chatham for many years, worked out of the fish pier. His pickup truck was hit on Monday on Route 6 by a another truck, and unfortunately he died at the scene. He is being remembered by local folks as sort of a consummate fisherman, the type of Cape Codder who would go from fishery to fishery depending upon where the fish were, so to speak, and if he couldn't go fishing, he would go shell fishing. You know, we hear stories about that's the way it was years ago for a commercial fisherman around here, and he sort of carried on that tradition. People say he was a nice guy, very very friendly, and sort of kept to himself, sort of a typical Cape Cod fisherman. And unfortunately, people around here are very very sad about this incident. And the latest, the state police are still investigating this accident. They say there are no charges have been issued yet, and they're still trying to figure out really what happened.
Our thoughts go out to his family and friends. That is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
You may go to LeCount Hollow in Wellfleet to surf. And now you'll be able to surf the web as well. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent joins us to explain what's going on. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve.
This is part of an effort to bring Wi-Fi connectivity to some Outer Cape beaches, but it's getting kind of a spotty reception from some beachgoers. Jump in here. Tell us what's happening.
Yes, spotty reception is exactly right. So this is a project that was created by the Cable, Internet, and Cellular Service Advisory Committee in Wellfleet, and really pushed by the vice chair of that committee, who's a fellow named Stephen Kopitz. And the rationale for it was safety from shark attacks. And of course, we all remember that in September 2018, Arthur Medici of Revere was killed in a shark attack at Newcomb Hollow Beach in Wellfleet. Incidentally, that was the first shark attack death in Massachusetts in 80 years. Mm. Many people pointed out that there was really, terrible cell phone service at the ocean beaches here, and you had to run all the way up the dune to get even a spotty cell phone reception. So the town at the time installed emergency call boxes at all four of the ocean beaches that automatically call 911 when they're picked up, but that didn't satisfy the Cable, Internet, Cellular Service Committee, and they got $200,000 from the state and another $55,000 from the town to install Wi-Fi at LeCount Hollow, and that happened on August 20th White Crest and Cahoon Hollow will soon follow. So three beaches will have this Wi-Fi. But the reactions have been very mixed.
Well, tell us that. Some people are just sort of rolling their eyes or saying we don't need to enable young people to go to the beach and be on their phones.
Well, that's exactly it. Peter Perzagotsky, who lives in Eastham, told us, told Sam Pollock, our reporter, I don't think it's necessary. It gives kids another option to sit on their phones, he said. And the chances of a shark attack, he noted, are one in a million. Mm. A couple of lifeguards at LeCount Hollow said that everybody they knew was against it. Abby Farrell, one of the lifeguards, said it takes away from our hoboness here. Jenny Layton said a fun part of growing up here was telling your friends, we're going to the beach. Come and find me.
Yeah. I guess there's one other thing that goes along with this. There's a kind of a push to put beach cams there now that there's Wi-Fi so that people can click online and see what's happening at the beach or at the parking lots. What is this?
Yeah, so this is another idea of Mr. Kopitz, who ran for select board unsuccessfully earlier this year. And he wants to now install surveillance cameras at the beaches on the poles with the Wi-Fi routers to serve as monitors for those who are looking for a parking space. He says people are, you know, we're spending a lot of money just waiting in line for a parking space at the beach. And he thinks this would be a great business. He wants to have a Wellfleet app where you could, you know, make restaurant reservations and, you know, do other things like that. He presented this idea at the Cable Advisory Committee, and they shot it down. He went to the select board, and they also shot it down, but he's pursuing it nevertheless.
The select board chair said, and it's a quote, we've been flooded with emails by people who do not seem to feel the least bit deprived by not having cameras at the beaches.
That's right. That was John Wolfe. He said, I have yet to see an email in support of it. And Suzanne Grout-Thomas, who's the beach director, community development director, called it the antithesis of what Wellfleet represents. Mm-hmm. So I don't think Mr. Kopitz has a big opportunity here, but he's relentless in pursuing it. So we'll see what happens.
It's Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Hey, Ed, before you go, I just want to shout out your reporter, Sophie Manshafir, who has a great look at Carnival this year, which just happened in Provincetown. The story has plenty of great photos. I encourage everyone to go look at that one. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Grace Ferguson of the New Bedford Light. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. One day soon, it's likely, train service will connect the South Coast to Boston. The tracks are now there, even the stations. Grace Ferguson from the New Bedford Light joins us to explain why it's going to take just a little longer. Hi, Grace.
Good morning, Steve.
The MBTA, which will operate this service, is testing safety systems along the route. It's complicated, it sounds like. Tell us what's involved.
It is extremely complicated. We went on a tour of the tracks between Berkeley and New Bedford, and at just one interlocking and railroad crossing in Berkeley, there were more than 500 tests that they were going to have to complete. There's a lot of safety systems along this route designed to prevent trains from going too fast or colliding. And all of those systems have to be tested one by one and also in sequence. And so there's a lot of tests to complete to make sure that the trains are going to be safe when they finally start running at their target date in May 2025.
Now, when you say you went on a tour along this route, the fact is you drove in a kind of SUV along the tracks, actually on the tracks. Is that right? I'm so jealous. Tell us about this.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping for a train, but the train that day was busy doing safety testing. They were running it along the tracks doing all those safety tests I mentioned. And so we were in kind of like a modified SUV where these train-like wheels descend and then hook onto the tracks. And so it felt a lot like a train ride. It sounded a little bit like a train ride, but we were in a vehicle that could also drive on the road.
There's a lot to talk about here because it's how they're putting together this rail route that people have been waiting for a long time and anticipating a long time is really a complex undertaking, and you went behind the scenes here. But just give us a sense of what the time arc is right now. People are they are hoping to have this route operational late in the spring next year?
Yes. So this phase of safety testing is kind of like the longest stretch. It will go until January. And what they're testing right now are the automatic train control and the positive train control systems. Automatic train control is done. They're just focusing on positive train control. And this is the system that will stop the train if the engineer isn't responding to safety signals like you're going too fast or you're about to hit another train. So that safety testing is going to go until January. And then at that point, that kicks off another process that's up to federal regulators. So the Federal Railroad Administration will come in, and they're going to want to watch the MBTA do what's called simulated service. And so that's where they're running the trains, stopping them at the stops, opening the doors and everything as if they were carrying passengers. And then once federal regulators sign off on that process, which normally that's about a three-month process, the goal is that in May 2025, the MBTA will finally be able to start carrying passengers.
You write a little bit about what it's going to take for conductors, or I guess engineers, people who drive the trains, to be certified here. And they have to be able to draw a map of the entire route and all the different interlockings. And they have to know essentially the whole track line forward and backwards, it sounds like.
Exactly. Yeah. So just as they're testing the safety systems and all the computer systems, at the same time, they have crews out on the tracks learning the route. And you're exactly right. They have to be able to draw every single interlocking from memory to prove that they know exactly how it all works. And then they're also just kind of learning the route in general. They're going to learn, okay, when I pass this house, that's when I need to start applying the brakes.
This word in interlocking, this was new to me when I read this. Explain what an interlocking is and why there are so many and why they're so complicated here.
So that's just a place where the train can switch directions or switch tracks. And that's important because they need to be able to get trains on different tracks to get around each other. So you don't have two trains heading towards each other in different directions. And they're really complicated because there's so many different directions you can go on any interlocking. At the one we visited, there were four stretches of tracks and you could go in 35 different ways throughout that interlocking. And then it just second goes back to the safety systems in that you don't want trains to be in a position where they might collide or might be going too fast and run off the tracks. And so all of these safety systems, particularly that positive train control that I mentioned, they're there to prevent that from happening.
One of the other things that they have to consider, or they have considered, I guess, as they were building the tracks, has to do with turtles and actually providing access for turtles to be able to cross the tracks without climbing over the rails. Is that right? Describe this.
Yeah. So some of the tracks go through eastern box turtle habitat, and the turtles will sometimes go on the tracks and then get stuck on their back. And so what they did was they built sort of like little tunnels under the tracks that the turtles can use so that they don't try and go over them. And we don't know how it works. We don't know how they know to use them, but they do.
The last thing I want to ask you is, you kind of press them on why it seems like the launch date for this keeps moving back. It's been moved back several times, and it's been such a long time coming. And you weren't really, I mean, they keep saying it's about safety and doing it right, but what was your sense of where they're at with this?
I mean, it does seem that they are continuing with the safety testing. They hit a milestone recently where after they finished testing that automatic train control system, they passed off the dispatching duties to Keolis, which is the contractor that runs commuter rail. So they are clearly making progress. Mm-hmm. And we did ask them, how did we get to this point where you had two delays in a year? This project was originally supposed to start by the end of 2023. Then they delayed it to this summer. And now the date is May 2025. I didn't really get a complete answer on that, but we are still asking questions, and the Light has asked for an interview with the MBTA's general manager to get more information.
That is Grace Ferguson of the New Bedford Light. Grace, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
A sleepy week on Beacon Hill as most lawmakers are out of town. Meanwhile, state officials are still concerned about the fate of Stuart hospitals in Massachusetts, and voters go to the polls on Tuesday after the holiday weekend for the state primary. CAI's Gilda Geist talked about these stories with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. Here's their conversation.
Hey, Gilda. Good morning.
So, Katie, we're now just 2 days away from Stuart Healthcare closing its hospitals in Dorchester and Ayr. Can you tell us a little bit about what does this mean for hospital staff and patrons?
Yeah, so obviously, I mean, in those specific areas in Boston and the Neshoba Valley, that means the local hospital is going to close. That's going to mean particularly one of the things we've heard concerns about is longer transport rides for EMS patients. There's concerns about what if people show up at the emergency room over Labor Day weekend seeking care. Longer term, it means that they'll have to transfer their regular care and medical needs to other facilities, which in some cases could mean longer drives or trips on public transit. Beyond those two pockets geographically, there's concerns too because the state's healthcare system as a whole is overburdened, and funneling people to other hospitals that have their own capacity challenges could cause broader problems beyond just these regions. So we'll definitely be watching to see what happens. And we've been hearing really an outcry from these communities, including some folks who rallied up at the State House this week.
And what did those ralliers want from Governor Healey, and how did the governor's office respond?
There's another Stuart Hospital in Brighton that the state is looking to seize the property by eminent domain to help transfer it to a new operator. The people who work at and are served by these hospitals are wondering why that isn't an option for them. They'd love to see the state maybe tap into its rainy day fund, its savings account, to fund keeping those hospitals afloat. They want the state to enforce the law here in Massachusetts that requires 120 days notice for a hospital closure. This has been moving more quickly. And they really just want to see the state do whatever it can to keep the doors open at Neshoba Valley Medical Center and Kearney Hospital. The governor's office says that she shares the frustration of the patients and the workers here, but there are not buyers who are qualified who have emerged to take over these hospitals. So that they say there's not much they can do on that front, but they're working to help patients transfer their records and care and to help staffers, healthcare workers find new jobs at other facilities.
And once these hospitals close in a couple days, is that it? Is there any chance that they could reopen?
A Boston city councilor did give voice to the idea that the fight's not over after Saturday. Once these hospitals close, that they're going to do something, the supporters of these hospitals, to try and keep them open. We don't really know what that's going to look like. When hospitals have closed in the state in recent years, they've pretty much stayed closed. But there is certainly an outcrying here. We know in Boston at the Dorchester Hospital, Mayor Michelle Wu has said she wants to limit whatever goes in there next to something that would be a healthcare facility. So I think we'll see people keep up the fight regardless of what happens.
Moving on, looking ahead to next week, in just a few days here in Massachusetts, we'll have our state primary. That'll be Tuesday, September 3rd. What are the biggest or most hotly contested races on the ballot this election?
This is a pretty sleepy primary. The marquee race is on the Republican side, where three candidates are vying to challenge Elizabeth Warren in the U.S. Senate. And that's two of them. John Deaton and Ian Kane are seeking out kind of a more moderate approach. Both of them have cryptocurrency backgrounds. And then we have Bob Antonellis, who's linking himself more to President Donald Trump. So it'll be interesting to see what direction the state's Republican voters choose to go in there. Beyond that, it's mostly the state legislature that's up for re-election, and two-thirds almost of state lawmakers face no challenges in either Tuesday's primary or the general election later this fall. So it's quiet on most of the ballot. That is a little different in the Cape and the Islands, where there are some outgoing state lawmakers that have created open seats, more competition there. So there's a couple House races with active primaries there that will be interesting to see as voters choose who they want on the November ballot. And the interesting thing is you do see that borne out in the early voting turnout numbers so far. The Cape and Islands have, relatively speaking, pretty high turnout in mail-in and early voting so far, with towns like Brewster, Eastham, and Orleans leading the state at more than 17% turnout still days before the primary is statewide, were about 9% total.
Katie Lannon from the State House, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That is CAI's Gilda Geist speaking with our State House reporter, Katie Lannon. You're listening to the Local News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. So we just had CAI's Gilda Geist recorded from earlier on Morning Edition, but now we've got her live in the studio with us. She's everywhere. Hi, Gilda.
Hi.
We have got you here to talk about a story you reported this week. It's about shellfish, like oysters and mussels, and how they can ingest large amounts of fiberglass from their environment. That's the finding of a new scientific study. Start by telling us about the study itself. Where is it from, and what did it look at?
Yeah, so this was a report published in the Journal of Hazardous Materials just last month, and it was done by a team of scientists led by Karina Chokan. She's an ecotoxicologist, and she works at the University of Brighton in the UK. And Chokan and her team studied shellfish that came from Chichester Harbour, which is in the south of England. And it's actually a lot like Cape Cod in that it has lots of biodiversity, lots of aquatic life, and at the same time, it's a hotspot for human activity.
And the results show that these shellfish located near boatyards are ingesting a lot of this material.
Yeah, so apparently I didn't know this before, but most modern recreational boats are made out of this composite material called GRP, which stands for glass reinforced plastic. And so when that material comes off of these boats, the plastic parts and the fiberglass parts actually separate. And so the plastic is light, so it floats on the surface of the ocean, which is a major source of microplastics. And then the fiberglass is heavy, so it sinks to the ocean floor. And that's where all the shellfish live, and that's how they end up ingesting the fiberglass. And Chokan and her team actually literally counted up the fiberglass shards piece by piece under a microscope. And they were genuinely surprised by how much fiberglass they found in these creatures.
One of the challenges that she points to here is that just how many fiberglass boats there are and the lack of ways really to dispose of them properly.
Yeah, so here in the United States, there are about 12 million recreational boats, and Chokan says that most of those are made with the glass-reinforced plastic, the GRP, and each year about 10% of those boats get too old, and they have to be retired, and yeah, there's no way to recycle them. It is apparently quite common to just abandon your boat in the water when it gets too old. Chokan was explaining that bringing your boat to a scrapyard can cost thousands of dollars, but ditching it is free, and those boats will shed microplastics and fiberglass into the ocean.
Maybe my favorite part of this interview is when you asked her if, after all this research, she still eats shellfish.
Yeah, she does. So Chokan told me she's not a fan of oysters, unrelated to the fiberglass, but she loves mussels. And so you might think doing this kind of research would make you not want to eat shellfish, but Chokan explained that fiberglass is, unfortunately, a powerful enough contaminant where it is likely to kill shellfish before they ever get to our plates. So in some ways, this is good because it means we're not eating fiberglass, but it's also not good because it means our shellfish are facing an existential threat. And even if you don't like shellfish, that's kind of a problem for our environment.
And again, to underscore, these were shellfish outside, located near a boatyard where a lot of this work was going on. I just want to take a quick moment to connect some of the dots here. In part, you came to the story as we were discussing the failed Vineyard wind turbine, which is very similar in construction to a fiberglass boat. But this study really points to a much larger problem, right?
Yeah, so glass-reinforced plastic was invented about 100 years ago, Chokan says, and so fiberglass has been contaminating our environment for quite a while now. So while Chokan says the smaller pieces of fiberglass from the wind turbine blade have almost certainly sunk to the sea floor, well, they'll likely be consumed by the creatures that live there, unfortunately, fiberglass contamination in our oceans is nothing new.
That is CAI's Gilda Geist. Gilda, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all our guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We spoke with Noah Glasgow of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent and Grace Ferguson of the New Bedford Light. We heard from our Statehouse correspondent, Katie Lannon, and we spoke with CAI's Gilda Geist. Big thank you to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. Butterflies follow him to the coffee shop. He's charmed that way. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.